Well, I trust that brought back some memories of Scripture, of what we understand as the context in which the events that we now refer to as Christmas took place. I trust some of the songs were familiar, maybe all of them. And that usually brings pictures to our minds. My question is, are the pictures that we have in our minds accurate as it relates to what actually happened there in Bethlehem so many years ago? And do we appreciate the details of how and when this took place? Was the world ready for this event? Well, I want to direct our attention to a particular text of Scripture, which should tell us something. Galatians 4, verses 4 through 5 says, "But when the fullness of time had come," that means perhaps things have been in process, getting ready, preparing for this event. "When the fullness of time had come, God sent forth His Son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law, that we might receive the adoption as sons." What does this tell us? Well, just a couple things to point out. One, prophetic timeliness. This had been predicted and had been prepared. It was in process and was coming to reality. Also, there is divine initiative because God sent forth His Son. There was human generation born of a woman. There was a reference to legal or even national implications, referring to those under the law. There's a sense in which we're all under law because God is ultimately in control. We're under Him, but also referencing the Jews who were under the law in an even more specific sense. And then that we might receive the adoption as sons. That's personal or relational restoration. All that's wrapped up in that verse. And I'm not going to take a look at all of those details, but I at least want to bring out a few things. One is, I want to think about it in terms of the prophetic timeliness, the preparation, and then a few other details. And I want us to think about the political context that was in view when this happened as it relates to when the fullness of time had come. What is involved in that? Well, for one thing, it was the time period of what is known as the Pax Romana, or the Roman peace. Events had taken place to bring certain things together. And there are several things that stand out. At this time, there was a common language. Alexander the Great had conquered the then-known world for the most part, in that region at least, around the cradle of civilization and so on, or around the Mediterranean Sea, all of that. And he brought the Greek culture and the Greek language so that it was now prominent in that area. There was also a good network of roads, because after the Greeks, then the Romans took over, and they brought about the Roman peace. But in order to do that, they had to be able to get around to places. They had to be able to get the army to places. And so there were these roads that were put together. Now, this is not an advertisement encouraging good roads, but those are helpful things, things we take for granted. If you go somewhere where there are no roads, you have a greater appreciation, because you had to be able to control, to communicate, and get around. They didn't have cell phones and television and radio and internet and all the things that we take for granted today. There was also international mobility, because all of the nations in this region were under Rome. There was a working relationship. You could get around. You didn't have to deal with the TSA. They didn't have the terrorism issues that we had. Or if they did, they were squashed immediately. But it's interesting to look at these things. It turns out these things were very timely as it relates to the communication of the gospel. It provided an environment that was a safe, functional environment for the Messiah to come, but also it provided an environment that made it easy for the communication of the fact that He had come to share this good news. But when we think about each of these things, why were they done? Were they done so that the gospel could be spread around the world? No, they were done for purely selfish political reasons. That's interesting to think about. There are things that are done in our world for selfish political reasons, and we look at them and we say, that's awful, they shouldn't do that. These things were done to provide just the right environment for the fullness of time to be realized that God sent forth his Son. Now, also what we recognize, during this period of time, there was the fulfillment of various prophecies. And we find in reading the book of Daniel that there were going to be four successive empires. These included the Babylonians, the Medo-Persians, the Greeks, and the Romans, and they had their different influences, as we've already noted, with regard to language and culture with the Greeks, and then the Romans had this control and provided this peaceful environment. All of these things took place. Also, just previous to this roughly 400-year period of time, Israel had been punished. The nation had been taken into captivity into Babylon, and they had been purged to a significant degree. Idolatry, as the major problem, had been essentially eliminated. Other things came about during this time because they weren't able to worship at the temple, so they had the beginning of the synagogues. We had the Pharisees and the Sadducees. All of these things were coming together at this time. That's somewhat of the political background. There's also the theological background, because we have had 400 years of silence after the nation Israel had been punished and taken to Babylon and then brought back. We had the period of the return and the remnant coming back to the nation, and we had 400 years of silence where it seemed like God wasn't saying anything, wasn't doing anything, and yet we see all of the stuff that Daniel had prophesied was taking place. Things were coming together. God was actively at work behind the scenes. And there was no word from God until it was the right time, until it was necessary. And then there was an explosion of divine intervention. When we think about God making himself known through the angels, etc., to Zechariah, Elizabeth, Mary, Joseph, the shepherds, the wise men. So there was 400 years of silence while things were being prepared. And then all of a sudden, everything happens at once. It's amazing when we think about that context. When God breaks in, he does so for good reason. And we also see that when Jesus then came on the scene after all this preparation, he was God with us. So there was silence, and then God himself shows up on this earth. So when he breaks into the world, he does so for good reason, and he had good reason to do so. Sometimes it's obvious, and sometimes it's obscure. God is often working behind the scenes. And he was working to preserve the nation Israel because they had gone astray. God was wanting to straighten them out because Satan was working overtime to destroy the nation. You know, Satan's still at work. He's still working to destroy nations. And we see stuff in our own nation and the frustrations that are along with it. God is in some ways somewhat silent right now, although we see things working behind the scenes, just as at that time. And God intervened in the past, and he will do so again. And there's going to be another explosion of divine intervention. That is coming. The Bible predicts it. So even though it seems kind of quiet right now, things are in process. And sometimes we get a little impatient, and sometimes we get a little nervous because we think things are moving too fast. Slow it down a little bit. Because we see things somewhat going down the tubes in some ways, but yet we see things are coming together just as they had previously. Now I want to take a slight diversion here and think about the cultural context and ask the question, what was it really like in Bethlehem? Now everybody has the picture in your mind you know, with the manger scene and the humble conditions and all that sort of thing. What was it like? Do I have an accurate picture of what it was like? Where did Mary and Joseph actually stay when they were in Bethlehem? Was it a stable, a barn, a cave, a house? I've heard and seen images of all of those things. So which is it? There's a reference to a manger. That's the one thing that sort of jumps out at us. How does the manger fit into the equation? That's where we sort of maybe go to seed a little bit at times, trying to figure that out. Too fast. In Luke 2:7, a familiar passage, it says, "She brought forth her firstborn son and wrapped him in swaddling cloths and laid him in the manger," or in a manger, "because there was no room for them in the inn." We need to think for a moment about what was that manger and what was this about an inn? What exactly is in view here? Now, the common view is that Jesus was laid in a wooden manger that we imagine, and that it was located, it was in like a stable behind the local Hampton Inn or the Holiday Inn or the Days Inn or the Woodbridge Inn or any number of the inns. That's the picture we have in our mind. The hotel was full, and so they had to go find this stable. Is that what it was exactly? Well, the word that's translated manger means feeding trough. And actually, in the song that we were singing and the words, the scriptures that it was quoting was using the Holman Standard Bible Version, and it actually said feeding trough, but we just didn't feel real comfortable with that, jumping right into that. But that was a good translation. That's what it actually is. It was a feeding trough. I have a picture of one. This is from Megiddo, and this is what it looked like. It was a stone feeding trough, and it is the assumption on the basis of study and looking at the times that that's probably what it was that was in view. And we still have the picture in our mind of the innkeeper being approached by Joseph and Mary and heartlessly telling them that they have to go to stay in a stable because there was no room in the inn. Where do we get that? It is pure conjecture. Now you're going to have to go back and look at your manger scene and see, is this right? Was the manger made out of wood? So you have to start with that. So you got to get out and chisel a manger out of a piece of stone. But the text only mentions the manger. And there's the hazard that we often have in Scripture of reading back our culture into the text. And, of course, we're looking at the English, so we need to think about that. But we need to think about what was the situation that they were dealing with here. We need to come back to the text of Luke chapter 2, verses 1 through 5. Where it says, "And it came to pass in those days that a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be registered." This, again, is another political movement, a political choice that was made with no view whatsoever in mind that, oh, if I have this decree and we have a census, then it's going to allow the Messiah to be born at the right place at the right time. No, Caesar Augustus wasn't thinking about that at all. It's just, this is what I want to do right now. It says this census took place when Quirinius was governing Syria, so all went to be registered, everyone to his own city. Joseph also went up from Galilee out of the city of Nazareth, where they were currently living, into Judea, to the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was of the house and lineage of David, to be registered with Mary, his betrothed wife, who was with child. So, if he's going back to his hometown, what is the chance that there might have been someone that they knew living in that town? 50% chance? I'm going to go with 99.9% chance that there were relatives living there, and that that's who they were going to go and stay with. So we need to think about, what about the translation of this word in? The word appears three times in the New Testament. That's helpful. When a word only appears once, it's a little more difficult. It appears three times, once in 2:7, and then in Luke 22:11 and Mark 14:14, where it refers to the upper room or a guest room. Now try to think through that for a moment. If that's the word that's used, was there some significance to that? Hey, getting ahead of me. There's a more specific word for inn. If the Holiday Inn was intended, then it would have used a different word. That word is pandokion, and it's found in Luke 10:34, where the Samaritan had found this individual who was hurt and brought him to an inn and took care of him. The next verse talks about dealing with the innkeeper. Again, a word that's just a slight variation of that same word is used there. So if an actual inn was intended, then there's another word that could have been used, and it would have made it really clear that that's what was in view. But the word in Luke 10:34 has the idea of lodging for travelers, and it has that inn idea, like the Hampton Inn or such. But the word that's used in Luke 2:7 is kataluma, or kataluma, and it means room or guest room. So, and then when you look at how it's used in Luke 22:12 and Mark 14:15, it's talking about the upper room, and there's a specific room that's in view. And this is consistent with the constructions of homes at that time. The picture that you see up here gives you a little bit of an idea. There's the entryway, and then there's an open courtyard here, and the stairway going up to an upper area. And here you have another picture, and this has animals down. This is where they would keep their animals. They didn't have farms. The homes were kind of like town homes in a way. They were kind of built right next to each other. And the first level would usually have this courtyard area and was used for storage, for cooking, and for keeping animals after dark. And then there would be the stairway that would lead upstairs and would often have at least one open room, if not more, that would be for sleeping, for family gatherings and such. Now, does that all of a sudden change the picture that's in your mind just a little bit? So I think the likely scenario is that the upper room would have been for sleeping, and that would have been full with other guests because of all the other relatives that are coming back. And so Jesus would likely have been born on the lower level, and there would have been a feeding trough there. I had some other pictures that showed, you know, like a feeding trough. That could be one right there, potentially. I'm not sure. But that's kind of the picture that comes to my mind. And then in Matthew, we read, and this is the account of the wise men coming. It says, and when they had come into the house, doesn't say stable, it says, come into the house, they saw the young child with Mary, his mother, and fell down and worshipped him. And that's the normal word for house. So I think that kind of fits together. It reminds me of the occasion that we had this past year at Christmas when our families converged on what we refer to as the Garden Lakes Resort in Phoenix, my in-law's house. And we had eight sleeping upstairs in three bedrooms, and we had six sleeping downstairs on air mattresses in the dining room, living room, and the study. And it all worked out. We had a great time. We were able to cram everybody in there. It can be done. And my view is that this likely was the picture and the scenario. So it's not quite as graphic as it relates to the element of condescension that we like to think of, though it makes good preaching. you know, the innkeeper, that mean guy, and being, you know, having to go out in the cold and stay in the barn or the stable or the cave or whatever. There was still kind of living outdoors to some degree, though there may have been covering what might have been one of the other rooms, likely in the bottom area. I think that's the picture, but it still communicates coming in humble circumstances, not their own place, borrowed, but there would have been people around that they knew. There would have been some encouragement of having family around. But what I want to communicate here is that it took prophetic timeliness, that is, the fulfillment of that which was predicted and that which was in the process of being prepared, to get Mary and Joseph to the right place at the right time. And again, political forces were at work. They were the instruments of fulfillment. Human political ambitions fulfilled God's great plans as if orchestrated from above. They were doing it by their own free will, and yet God was working, orchestrating everything together. And that ought to be somewhat of an encouragement to us, because we look around at the events that are going on and we see political exploitation all around the world, and we see people doing things for their own ends, and it's easy for us to get a little nervous, overwhelmed, concerned. But did God have a hard time dealing with the fact that these events were taking place? Not at all. He used them. They were necessary. It was part of bringing things together so that it would happen the way it was supposed to, when it was supposed to. We ought to take heart. We ought to be encouraged. We ought to celebrate this event with even more heartiness, because we have an understanding that God is still at work, and he's got some other things that are in process right now that we may or may not have a direct part in. And that ought to be some encouragement to us to be able to enjoy the provision that was made. Coming back to that text, when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his Son to redeem. Catch that. To redeem. That's for us, for you and me. That's good news. That's reason to celebrate. And that is why we are here to celebrate as well, and to wish us all Merry Christmas.